Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hey, I am back. Been away for 2 weeks in California and then in the Middle East, and I am back now for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. It's Peter Schiff. We do the show every Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific, on 5.07 megahertz shortwave and www.europac.net. Anyway, I'm going to be on Fox Business tomorrow for an hour. I mean, I'm the guest host or the guest, for the segment. It's the countdown to the closing bell. 3 to 4 p.m. on Fox Business, not Fox News, but Fox Business. Television appearance is up on my website. I have no idea, usually the shows come to me the day of the show. So if I happen to know in advance, like this one, I'm mentioning it now. But the best way, if you want to know what my upcoming shows are, is to remember to visit the website, the www.europac.net, and on the front page, to the extent that I know in advance about any television appearances, they're going to be up on the website, so you can come and see when I'll be there. Anyway, the number to call, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I see the lines are open. I think we have two callers so far, but plenty of room for people to call. Anyway, I guess a lot was going on while I was away, while I was, out of the country. And I had a great time over there in the Middle East. The Saudis were particularly gracious and nice hosts and showed me a good time. I didn't really pay too much attention to the conference that I was speaking at, this Global Competitiveness Conference. And then I happened to spend a couple days over in Dubai as well, very dynamic, interesting city that's got some financial problems now as a result of a lot of leverage that was going on over there, a lot of building. But they do have some magnificent buildings, which I ultimately think is going to be a positive for the town. I mean, once they get rid of some of the debt problems they have, because it's going to be a very competitive place for people to do business, because I think the rents are going to come down quite a bit for Dubai property, which will make it a lot less expensive for businesses to set up shop there when they can get real quality office space and amenities for a reasonable price. And, of course, there's no taxes there. There's no income taxes there. So it's certainly a good place to do business. I mean, Saudi Arabia, very different. I mean, culturally very different than the U.S. and not, as easy a city to be in if you're from a different culture. But they're certainly very friendly. The people there were extremely friendly, at least to me. But I'm sure it wasn't just me. But anyway, I'm glad to be back and doing the show. Hopefully, I know my brother did one of the shows. I think John Catalfio did the other show. Hope that they did a good job, and you guys enjoyed the programs in my absence. Anyway, just quickly speak a little bit about why I was gone. I know there was a blog piece written that was very critical of our investment strategy. And, it's funny, too, because when that piece came out, when that article came out, I mean, it was like there was some gigantic revelation, oh, my gosh, Euro Pacific Capital accounts are down. I mean, I don't know how anybody would be surprised by that. I mean, I talk about it all the time. We talk about it on this program. I talk about it on television. I talk about it on the radio. My investment strategy has been no secret, at least, a substantial part of it, which is to buy, foreign stocks, to get out of the dollar, to buy dividend paying foreign stocks. Of course, part of my strategy is to buy commodities, to buy gold, and obviously, when you have a situation where the dollar is going up, and stocks are going down all over the world. I think 2008 was the worst year in history, for foreign stocks. If I'm telling people to buy foreign stocks, they're obviously going to be down in 2008. Why that's even news, why that would even surprise people, that people who bought stocks based on my recommendation that those stocks would be down. I mean, it's just, you know. Now, I mean, obviously, too, I mean, I talked a lot about shorting stocks and about the fact that financials were going to go down and the U.S. market was going to go down. And, you know, many of my clients do short stocks, and a lot of them do it through discount brokers. I mean, they don't necessarily do it through me because I'm not a discount broker. So a lot of people who are shorting stocks based on my, you know, advice or, you know, my take on the market, they're doing so in non-Euro Pacific Capital accounts, although there are some clients who are shorting in their Euro Pacific Capital accounts. But, you know, a lot of people prefer to do it where they can pay a discount commission. You know, we have mainly the people executing the foreign stocks in my accounts because that's where I can add value because we can save money by, you know, by buying these stocks directly on foreign exchanges. So if people want to short U.S. stocks and buy foreign stocks, and generally they short their U.S. stocks someplace other than Euro Pacific Capital. And they buy through us. And the money that, you know, my clients are sending me are the money that they want me to invest in foreign stocks. They're not sending me the money they want to keep in cash. If they want to keep it in cash, they keep it in cash someplace else. Of course, we also buy a lot of gold for people. People send me money to buy gold, but, you know, the gold that we buy through the Perth Mint does not reflect on any of the Euro Pacific Capital statements because the gold is held at the Perth Mint. To the extent that my clients want to buy physical gold to have in their possession, which I also recommend, I, you know, just suggest that they go to a local coin store. I mean, I don't buy that for them, but I certainly recommend it, and I tell people that they should have physical gold. But the fact that our accounts are down, I mean, you know, of course. I mean, we're in stocks. We're I'm a value investor. I'm a long-term buy and hold guy. I'm trying to get out of the dollar. And obviously, during years when the dollar is up and stocks are down, the accounts are going to go down. But we're not keeping score on a short-term basis. I mean, obviously, you know, you can't evaluate a buy and hold strategy just based on a downturn in the market, because that's when it doesn't work. But over the long run is exactly when it does work. And the people who think, no, you should trade the market, you should buy and sell, yeah, in theory, it's great. Yes, sell before it goes down and buy before it goes up. But it's a lot harder to actually do real time. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's always easy to know. And I find it interesting that a lot of the people who are so quick to say how easy it is to time the market, it usually, you know, they usually don't have any money. And if they were such good market timers, if they always knew exactly when to buy and sell, why aren't they rich? You know, I mean, most of the people who claim to be able to trade the market, if they really could trade the market, they would just shut up and trade it. Like, for instance, the guy that wrote this blog, you know, that's criticizing me, I mean, apparently the guy's been a money manager in the business somehow for 10 years or 20 years, I read, but his firm is not even SEC registered, which means he doesn't even have $20 million in assets or $25 million in assets. I don't even think he has even a half of that or a quarter of that. But if he's such a great market timer, if he knows exactly what the markets are going to do, why does he even need clients? Why is he even advertising for clients? He should just be so stinking rich. You know, it's just, it's just easy for people to pretend that they know how to trade the market. But if they did, they wouldn't be drumming up business. I mean, I've always told people that I'm not even attempting to time the market. I mean, maybe it works in the short run. But I think in the long run, it's not the prudent thing to do, especially when we're trying to prepare for a event is catastrophic as what I see coming in the United States. You know, a lot of people are making a big deal about the fact, oh, Peter Schiff, you know, predicted the collapse, but look, his clients are down. Well, the collapse hasn't even really happened yet. I mean, that's the funny thing. The people who are giving me credit for having predicted the economic collapse, what they don't understand is that the lion's share of my prediction hasn't even happened yet. I mean, what we've seen so far is just the beginning, right? The bursting of the housing bubble, the bursting of the credit bubble, the beginning of the recession, this is not the crisis. This is what's going to lead to the crisis. Remember, the real crisis is not the bursting of the bubble. The real crisis is what the government does to reflate it, which is exactly what they're doing right now. And this is where the destruction of the dollar comes in. This is where the massive inflation comes in. It doesn't show up immediately. when the bubble burst, but it shows up as a result of what the government does to try to save the economy. And so ultimately, when this scenario completely plays out, this dollar rally that happened in 2008 will reverse, and the dollar will collapse. And then, obviously, all the anti-dollar stocks that we invested in will do well. And meantime, we're collecting our dividends. You know, it was interesting. The Wall Street Journal came out with a story also following up on this blog piece. And in that Wall Street Journal story, it's, you know, they quote somebody in there that says, oh, Peter Schiff's strategy is very risky. You know, it's not balanced. It's not, you know, it's just a risky bet. Well, the reason that they're saying this is because it's not in dollars. They're assuming that my goal is to preserve dollars, to have a balanced portfolio in dollars. They thought, oh, this, they're looking at my portfolios and saying, oh, these are 100% foreign. That's not prudent. That's a big bet. That's very risky. They only think it's risky based on their own perspective, which is that the U.S. dollar is safe. But if you come to the conclusion like I have, and like I think a lot of my clients, which is why they've sent me money, if you think the dollar is going to collapse, then it doesn't make sense to have any money in dollars. You have to get your money into foreign assets if you believe the dollar is going to collapse. Obviously, the mainstream guy that the Wall Street Journal went to look at this particular account to say, oh, this is, you know, this is very one-sided bet. Schiff is making a risky bet. In my mind, I'm not making a risky bet. I think the risky bet is keeping your money in the United States, keeping your money in the dollar. Now, of course, the particular portfolio they were looking at happened to be a portfolio that was, I think, 70% commodity companies, resource companies. So for whatever reason, that particular individual wanted to have a portfolio that was more commodity-based, which is fine as far as I'm concerned because I'm very bullish on commodities, but it is a very volatile type of portfolio. And if you put a portfolio like that together when the market is at the top, you know, the commodity markets anyway, the dollar's at the bottom, and you get the type of rally that we have, obviously you're going to have a rather big decline. But assuming that the commodity bull market is still intact, ultimately I think that individual will be ahead. I mean, because I don't think that, you know, we've seen the highs in the commodity bull market. And I think if the people were smart, you know, what they're doing is they're adding money, which a lot of clients are doing. We're adding money to the decline. We're reinvesting dividends. You know, I talked to a client today, you know, called up talking about her account that happened to be down. I think she was down about 40%, but she had a bunch of cash in the account. You know, we hadn't talked in a while, so she accumulated a lot of dividends. And the idea was to take that cash and reinvest it and take advantage of the opportunities that the market is affording us because the stocks are now so low. I mean, it doesn't really affect us in that we're not selling, but it certainly helps if we take our dividends and reinvest them and get favorable terms, because I don't think we're going to be able to do that for much longer. I don't know whether it's another 3 months, 6 months, or another year, but at some point the bottom's going to drop out of the dollar and the real crisis is going to begin. You know, we're not even there yet. I mean, people think that, you know, this is the tough times, this is the economic collapse that I was talking about. Not even close. It's not even close. I mean, so far the government has been able to bail everybody out. But when the real crisis happens, no one's going to get a bailout because the government itself is going to need a bailout. You know, when the bond market collapses and the dollar collapses, the government can't bail anybody out. It's going to be looking for a bailout by itself. And so things are going to get a lot worse. And if people think, oh, the crisis is over, the Euro-Pacific Capital crash-proof portfolios didn't work, they didn't work because the crash hasn't happened yet. You know, by the time this whole thing plays out and the dollar does collapse and consumer prices and commodity prices go through the roof, that's when we're going to see the success of our portfolios. In the meantime, we have to keep positioning ourselves for the outcome that we know is basically inevitable, and that's how we're investing. But, you know, I thought it was pretty funny that some of the people who I guess had been critics of mine or who were embarrassed by, you know, their parts in that Peter Schiff was right video. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, you know, accuse me of putting that YouTube clip together and promoting myself, you know, Peter got it right, Peter got it right. I mean, I didn't put that clip together. I mean, I didn't even find out about it until I saw it on YouTube like everybody else. So, you know, it's not me telling people I was right. It's somebody else coming to that conclusion and putting together a YouTube clip. I mean, I happened to send out a link to it when I noticed it because I thought it was an interesting compilation of appearances. But I certainly, I didn't even know the person. I still don't know the name of the person who did it. I think I sent him a couple of emails after the fact, but I don't even know who he is. But in any event, this one guy, you know, Mike Norman, who I appeared on him on numerous occasions on television, and more recently I thought we had a little bit of a friendly relationship, but apparently not. But when he found out about this thing, about this article on the blog, and then found out that there was going to be a Wall Street Journal, the guy was like, I went and listened to his show, and he was so excited. He was like, breaking news on Peter Schiff. Peter Schiff is a fraud. This is huge. This is huge news. Like, I'm a fraud because I have clients that are down. I mean, when did I ever claim that everybody was up? But, and then he started comparing me to Adolf Hitler and Jim Jones and Bernie Madoff. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. But it shows, you know, I mean, he was just so excited that some of my clients were down. Whereas if you followed this guy's investment advice, you'd have been wiped out years ago. In fact, I don't even know if he has any clients. I mean, I don't think he does. But certainly anybody who followed his investment advice over the years would have lost a lot of money. They, you know, long before 2008 came along, they would have been broke. But he was acting like the Wall Street Journal was going to expose me as a fraud. And I guess he was very upset that the article wasn't even more biased against me than it was. I mean, it started out, you know, with a negative tone, but I mean, they interviewed three people. I mean, two of the people had portfolios that were down a little over 60%. One of them had a portfolio that was down by 35%, which shows you that, you know, there's very different results for different portfolios depending on what people had. And of course, you know, I don't, you know, if any of these individuals, I don't know who they were, but if any of these individuals own precious metals, obviously the precious metals that were up in 2008 were not even reflected on those statements, so the returns might have been skewed because any of the positive performance from gold bullion wouldn't have reflected. But the fact is, one of the people was only down 35%, which was actually less than the S&P. And, you know, Berkshire Hathaway, you know, Warren Buffett's fund is down 40%, over 40% in the last 13 months, which is, you know, that's a greater decline than many of my clients had. And, you know, I mean, the Wall Street Journal isn't writing an article about, you know, about Berkshire Hathaway and accusing Warren Buffett of making mincemeat out of his clients, which is how the journal described what happened to my clients in 2008. But it's interesting, you know, a lot of people ended up calling the Wall Street Journal, and they didn't really publish any of those conversations. I think, in fact, one of my clients told me that they called up the Wall Street Journal and tried to tell them that their account was positive, and the Wall Street Journal reporter told them that they must be reading their statement wrong, that that's not possible, that they couldn't be positive. But, you know, they had a story that they wanted to tell. They thought it was a big story that there were clients at Euro Pacific Capital that were down. And, you know, as I said, I mean, all I had to do is go on the Internet. They had to just listen to any of my radio shows, and they would know that, read any of my newsletters or, you know, They don't, it's not a big piece of investigative journalism to find this out. But, you know, another guy that made a big deal about this guy, Don Luskin, I mean, wrote something about it on his website. And, you know, it's just amazing, you know, that people are jumping all over me because, you know, Euro Pacific Capital clients were down in 2008. And Don Luskin is making a big deal about it. This is the guy, Don Luskin. I don't even know if he manages any money anymore. I have no idea what Trend Macro has. But I know that the thing that he's famous for was he set up an internet fund in 2000 at the peak of the internet bubble. And he started a fund. He launched this fund. And within a year, it was down, I think, 80%. And they had to shut it down. So here's a guy that couldn't have timed the market any worse, jumped in at the very peak of the biggest stock market bubble ever, loaded up on the most overvalued stocks, wiped everybody out, and now he's criticizing me. You know, I was making money in 2000 for my clients. I was buying the commodity stocks, and the, you know, I was buying gold and oil, and I was buying value back when he was chasing dot-com stocks. So the fact that he's going to try to criticize me because we had one down year in 8, you know, now sure, it was a big down year, but you know, everybody had a big down year. But again, I think what's happened now, it's laying the foundation for a spectacular rise in the exact types of stocks that we're buying, because as this crisis really unfolds and moves into high gear and we see the real outcome, right, not what we've seen so far, but the real outcome, the meaningful drop in the dollar and maybe a complete drop depending on, you know, how long the government pursues these foolish stimulus policies and bailouts, all of which is going to make the situation worse and lead to staggering inflation and hopefully, but potentially hyperinflation if the government doesn't come to its senses in time and do a complete about face. But that's when people are going to see the wisdom of this strategy. And, you know, I think it's interesting, too, that the investment strategy is now being attacked by so many people. I feel a lot better about it. You know, when I first started, you know, buying the foreign stocks and buying commodities, most of my fellow people in the investment world made fun of that. I mean, they said, oh, that's wrong, that's wrong, don't do that. But starting in about 2007 is when everybody seemed to embrace my strategy. And they were embracing it for the wrong reasons. But all of a sudden, you know, I did the last bull bear debate I did at the Money Show. Both Joe Battipaglia and Louis Navalier, who had been criticizing me for 2 or 3 years, all of a sudden, they were buying energy stocks, they were buying agriculture stocks, they were buying gold stocks, they were buying all the same types of companies I was, but for the wrong reasons. But they were buying them. I think they're probably flushed out of the market by now. I think all of the speculators who came late to the market, who really didn't understand the trends, didn't understand why things were happening, but jumped on board anyway and did it with a lot of leverage, I think they're all flushed from the market. And I think we're going to be able to resume the trends that were in place before the leverage speculators came on board. And I think ultimately we're going to have much bigger rises before they come back, if they even have the ability to come back, because they might have wiped themselves out on margin. I mean, that's one of the fortunate things about my clients. Even though some of my clients, and you know, we have losses and some substantial losses, they're not on margin, so nobody is getting forced out. No one is having to sell into this insane market. No one is having to accept 2 or 3 or 4 times earnings for their stock. No one's having to give away these stocks at these huge dividend yields. We're able to ride out the volatility, whereas a lot of the leverage players were not able to do that. I mean, they were just forced out of the market. Anyway, so let me quickly talk a little bit about what's going on, you know, in the economy before I grab the phones. First of all, you know, the bond market, it's very interesting. If you look at the yield on the bond market, bond prices have been falling every day so far for 2009. In fact, if you look at the bond market, the yield on the 30-year bond has moved up from 2.5% in late December to, I think, 3.7% now. This is already the worst year in history for bonds, worst year, even though we're only through the month of January. So the January was a worse year by itself than any other entire year, you know, January through December. And the momentum seems pretty solid. I mean, if we can get back up above 4%, 4.25% in the next month or so, then I think we can head up to 5.5%. And that's going to throw a monkey wrench into the idea that we can get, you know, mortgages down to 4%, which is something that Obama, I think, has been floating around. But I think that's a sign that things are going to start to go the other way. Look at the price of gold. Continues to move up, $900 an ounce. The Dow this week hit another record low in terms of gold. The Dow got down to 8.7 ounces of gold. I think it closed today at 9 ounces of gold. But again, this is another one of the forecasts that I've been talking about, how the U.S. stocks would continue to lose value relative to gold. Meanwhile, I have noticed that the foreign stocks have picked up, even though the U.S. market is pretty much on a new low right now. It's not an intraday low, but it's pretty close to a closing low. Most of the foreign markets are quite a bit off their lows, at least 10 to 20% off their lows, even though the U.S. market seems to be making new lows. And the dollar, I mean, the dollar is still relatively high in, you know, compared to where it was at the lows, but it's not making new highs. And to me, it looks like there's a good chance that the dollar is consolidating and looking to roll over and move back down the new lows. That it's kind of, you know, we had this big, huge rise in the dollar, then we had a big, sharp drop, and now we're having a rise, but we're not able to get back up to the old highs. And I think once this fails, if this is going to be a failure, if the dollar can't make a new high, then I think it'll make a new low. And when it makes a new low, I don't think there's a lot below it. I think it could be a very, very sharp and rapid decline, which is, you know, one of the reasons that we want to act as quickly as we can to take advantage not only of the strength of the dollar, which I think is very, very temporary, but the bargains in foreign stocks. And, you know, when you've got an artificially high dollar for whatever reason and stocks at fire sale prices around the world, you know, you win twice because you get to take overvalued dollars and buy undervalued stocks. And that's what people should be doing, and doing it as quickly, I think, as quickly as they can, because we don't know for sure when the bargains are going to be over. All I know is that they will be at one point, and I think a lot of people are going to have a lot of regrets with respect to the stocks that they didn't buy or the positions that they didn't average into when they had the opportunity. But generally, you know, when there is an opportunity to buy something cheap, a lot of people have a hard time doing it because the reason it's cheap is because there's a lot of fear. Oftentimes the fear is irrational, but it certainly doesn't feel that way. And, you know, so they say it's always, you know, it's difficult. It's always difficult to buy low and sell high, because when you're buying low, you're buying when everybody is concerned, when there's obviously a lot of problems, because that's why things are cheap. You know, it's much easier to buy when everything is great, when everybody is convinced that you can't lose. But of course, when you do that, you end up paying a high price because everybody is trying to buy and nobody is selling. Right now, everybody is trying to sell. But I think that what everybody is coveting so highly right now, cash, in particular the U.S. dollar, is the absolute worst place that you could be. By far, the worst place that you could be. We should be running from cash. People should be running towards real assets. You know, real something that's going to maintain its value in the face of all this inflation, all this money creation. And I think before too long, people will be shunning cash and looking to buy whatever they can, whatever real assets they can, to preserve their wealth, because it's not going to be preserved if it's in cash, particularly if the cash is U.S. dollars. You know, also too, real quickly before I go to the phones, there's a lot of news today, a lot of talk in the news about the companies that are getting money from the government, that got money through the TARP, getting bailouts, whether their salaries should be capped. I mean, you know, they're paying big bonuses, they're going on lavish trips or excursions, and they're throwing parties. And, of course, the taxpayers or the politicians are upset that companies are taking taxpayer money and just, you know, having a good time or paying high salaries. And, you know, the whole thing is, this is a discussion or an argument it shouldn't even be taking place, because the government should have let these companies fail. The government shouldn't have bailed out anybody. And if we hadn't bailed out anybody, then it wouldn't be an issue of how much they're paying or what kind of parties they're throwing, because there wouldn't be any. Either the companies would still be in business and they would be spending their own money, or they would have gone out of business. But instead, the government keeps them in business. And now, unfortunately, if the government's going to maintain their high salaries, even though the companies are losing money, then what incentive do they have to ever make money? I mean, they're just going to be permanent government positions and high-paying government positions at that, even though they're not delivering a service that anybody wants. I mean, we have to impose some discipline on their ability to lavish big paychecks on themselves without any regards to profit, because there's no longer a profit motive in there. Their salary is no longer a function of what they can earn in the market, because if they just can keep losing money every year and just line up for money from the federal government. And obviously, you know, they'll pay themselves as much as they can get away with. But, you know, the other problem is, of course, if they can't pay their executives, more than a certain amount of money, then a lot of these guys will quit and the firms will fail and go bankrupt. Well, fine. We should have just let that happen right off the bat. If that's what's going to happen, fine. But, you know, by propping these companies up, now we've got to support their ability to continue to overpay people. And it also makes it difficult for the industry to restructure, because smaller companies that didn't make all these mistakes, that might have been in a position to hire some of the workers that lost their jobs at some of these bigger firms, now they're not going to get that opportunity because the government is subsidizing their continued employment. And a lot of the smaller firms will never be able to earn enough money to make these huge bonus payments that these other companies could make, not because they're generating any profits, but because they've qualified for government aid. And they take that government aid and they use it to bid up wages, and they make it so that people aren't going to firms where their skills could better be used. And remember, the only way that we're going to get out of this economic mess is to allow a more vibrant economy to be created by private individuals. We need real wealth creation. We need real businesses. We need real factories to be established. And it's not going to happen from the government. The government's not going to do it. We need more resources in the private sector, but we have to let the private sector allocate them. And if the government's propping up these companies and keeping them in business with government money, they're interfering with that process, and they're preventing the economy from adjusting itself in a way that we need to, so that we can have a meaningful prosperity based on productivity, not just based on debt, not just based on borrowing money and spending it, which is the phony paradigm that is the reason that we're now in the mess that we are, and that it's going to get so much worse because the government doesn't understand this, and that everything the government is doing now and everything the government is going to do is simply going to make the situation much, much worse. You know, Barack Obama again was on television or today saying that we have to act, we need this gigantic stimulus. If we don't do this, it's going to be a catastrophe. It's going to be, you know, the bottom line is, it's going to be bad if the government does nothing. No question about that. But it's going to be much, much worse if the government does what Barack Obama is planning. And it's already going to be worse because we've done some of the things that the Bush administration wanted us to do. Anyway, let me quickly grab the phones. I got John, who's been waiting patiently for almost a half hour in Oklahoma. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Peter, how you doing today, buddy?
Good, how are you?
Good. Peter, I agree with virtually everything that you say. I believe you're a true patriot. There's not many people left out there that understand what made America great, and that's the people and the government staying out of the way, and I appreciate that. I've got a quick comment and then a couple quick questions. You know, I can understand, Peter, why there's some people out there that are frustrated because, you know, a client like myself that's down, you know, maybe 50% of their portfolio, and then you see Peter Schiff, you know, peddling something titled Peter Schiff is Right. You know, that's kind of hard to swallow for some people.
Yeah, remember, I'm not peddling anything that says Peter Schiff was right. I didn't produce that YouTube clip. Somebody else named it that I don't even know. But I think what he was talking about, I was right on. I was right on the economy. He's not saying I was right on, you know, every investment recommendation I made for 2008. What I'm talking about on that clip, we're talking about the housing problem. We're talking about the financials. We're talking about the credit crunch that's coming. You know, there's recession that's coming. I was clearly right on those things. There's nothing on that video that says Peter Schiff was right on what was going to happen to commodities in 2008 or what was going to happen to the dollar in 2008. I mean, there's nothing that makes any claims there.
Sure, I agree. And I think time will pan you out on that without a doubt, or I wouldn't be invested. Because the fundamentals, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, look, the only thing, in my mind, the only thing that I missed was the big rise in the dollar.
Yep.
And I don't think the rise in the dollar is permanent, so I don't think it's changing any of the things that, any of the outcomes, but it's delaying it. Because the dollar went up. When the dollar went up, that automatically meant that all of our foreign stocks went down. But when the dollar went up, it also undermined commodities. And so it hit the commodity stocks double. They lost because they were foreign and they were in foreign currencies and because the commodity went down. And also, we had this huge flight to the dollar. This is temporarily supporting the U.S. economy. If the dollar had been falling instead of rising, we would be in much worse shape right now because we would have much higher prices, much higher interest rates. Instead, because the whole world is rushing to U.S. treasuries, the world is suffering, and America is getting a free ride. So things in other countries are worse because capital is being diverted away from other businesses to the U.S. government. And it's just like a gigantic crowding out. So the global credit crunch is really a result of all the extra money that the U.S. government is now borrowing. And the fact that a lot of companies that loan money to Americans are not getting paid back, and now whatever money they have left is being borrowed by the U.S. government.
Right. Yep, I understand. And nobody can predict a 5,000-point drop in the Dow in a two-month period. And any time that happens, obviously everybody's going to run into cash, and therefore the dollar is going to rise.
You know, I didn't look in Crash Proof in my liquidity chapter, which was Chapter 10, I specifically wrote that I expected that when the U.S. market really started to decline, I expected foreign stock markets to decline as well. And that's why I said you want to have some cash available to take advantage of the bargains that are likely to develop as a result of that. Now, I didn't expect them to be this big a decline, but I expected it to happen. But I also didn't expect the dollar to fall. So I expected the declines in foreign stocks to be muted somewhat by the rise in the currencies. But that didn't happen. Instead of foreign currencies going up, making the drop in foreign stocks not as big, foreign currencies went down, and it made the drop seem even bigger.
Right. Makes
sense.
But it also
means that the declines can turn around very quickly. I mean, let's assume someone's account is down 50% like yours. You're going to say, okay, we need the market to double to get even. But you don't need it to double. Because if the market goes up by 50%, if you get the market going up by 50% or those stocks, and if the dollar goes down, you know, if the dollar goes down, you know, by 30% or so, then you'd be even.
Sure.
You don't need to have double, because you have two things happening. You have commodities and the dollar. And plus, if you have a lot of commodity stocks, the minute the dollar does go down 20 or 30%, commodities will probably go up a lot more than that. So, I mean, things can happen so that a lot of the stocks, you know, they drop very quickly. You know, to assume that, you know, the market dropped dramatically in 6 months and now, you know, it's going to take 5 or 10 years to get back, I don't think it's going to happen that way. I think the rally is going to be just as sharp, if not sharper, than a decline. And I think as fast as the paper losses built up, that's how fast the paper losses could evaporate.
Sure. Peter, my first question is about real estate. I'm in Oklahoma City. I own quite a few single-family homes. I've got them all rented out. And my question is somewhat hypothetical, and that's, let's say real estate bottoms out within the next year or so. You know, first of all, our market really hasn't been hit at all. Our market's stayed pretty steady, up 3, 4, 5% every year because we never had the boom.
Okay, you got to speed it up.
Let's say inflation's at 10%, what does the real estate market do?
I don't think real estate is going to be a good investment for a long, long time. I think all U.S. assets are going to be undermined by inflation. I think real estate prices are going to continue to fall in this country relative to the price of anything else. You're much better off investing abroad. I mean, American assets are going to get dramatically marked down. To the extent that you can borrow a lot of money, if you can do it without any real equity, then you might make money as your debts are inflated. But you're going to make money as a debtor. You're not going to make money as a real estate owner. Real estate in this country is going to lose a lot more value. Americans are going to lose a lot of wealth. Our country is going to be increasingly less competitive with the world. We're going to be more of a centrally planned economy. Decisions are going to be made in this country by politicians looking for votes, not by entrepreneurs looking to earn profits. We are not going to be a dynamic economy. We are going to be stifled by socialism and central planners and inflation, and our assets are going to lose tremendous amounts of value. I think you'll lose less money in real estate than bonds and CDs and money markets, but there's much better places for your money. And if you really want to buy real estate, buy it in Asia. You know, get into some of the real estate trusts we're buying where the dividend yields are 10%, and you can get quality properties in parts of the world that are going to experience a lot of growth over the next 10 years, not decline. Anyway, thanks
what
for
about
calling,
the...
John. I got to hop it. I mean, I've only got 23 minutes left. Let me take Ethan calling from Oregon.
Hello?
Yes, Ethan. It's Peter Schiff. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I have a comment and then a couple questions. My first comment is I think it's pretty obvious that your ideas are in very high demand, and I think I speak on behalf of all your fans when I say that you really need to do your radio show more than once a week. My first question is about the yuan. And according to Yahoo Finance, it's actually been appreciating against the U.S. dollar since mid-2005, and I was wondering if you could comment on that, please.
Well, they have been allowing it to appreciate slightly. I mean, they used to have a firm peg, and now it's a bit of a softer peg, where the Chinese government was gradually allowing the RMB or the yuan to appreciate. But it's still dramatically undervalued. I mean, the currency needs to be allowed to move up. They're still not doing it. I mean, the world is still subsidizing the United States. And, you know, part of my thesis and part of my, you know, the real collapse and the decoupling really is going to come when the currencies that are pegged to the dollar break their pegs. Because right now, it's hard for the world to decouple when they're forced to support us, when they have to prop up our economy and prop up our currency, and we're still stealing purchasing power away from the rest of the world, and it's being diverted to Americans. But when these other currencies, countries, you know, relinquish or give up these pegs, then their own citizens' currencies will strengthen dramatically, and you will see a surge in consumption in countries like China when the Chinese citizens are allowed to enjoy the benefits of a strong currency, which are the results of their hard work and their savings and their productivity. Right now, you know, we are enjoying the fruits of their labor, and they need to reclaim that. And that will happen eventually, but so far the politicians have still been dragging their feet, and that's, you know, and they're still propping up our economy at their expense.
Okay, thank you. My second question, could you explain in more detail, please, why it's worse in other places than in here? Because I still hear a lot of people saying, well, it's worse everywhere.
No, it's not worse. I mean, that's just people saying that. It's not worse. And the only reason that it doesn't appear to be worse here is we're still getting the subsidy. We're not getting a declining currency right now because other people are taking refuge in the dollar. But that's not going to last. You know, once the world flees the dollar, you know, we're going to see something similar to what they're seeing in Iceland right now. I mean, we're going to have a major, major economic disaster. We haven't even had it yet. But the real problems are in America. We are the source of the world's problems. We are the epicenter of it. This is a big, it's a credit crisis, but the crisis is that America borrowed all this money and America can't pay it back. And the American economy only exists if it can continue to go into debt. Our whole economy is based on ever-increasing debt, and that means the world has to supply us with that money. The world has to save and produce and give it all to America, and obviously that's not sustainable. But right now, the world, as I said, is suffering because the world is trying to maintain this ridiculous dynamic. But it is not worse every place else, and the minute the world comes to their senses, there'll be a boom outside the United States, and our economy will completely implode. And that is the collapse that we're planning for, not what we've seen so far. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The real decline, the real crisis, is coming in our future. We haven't even started it yet.
Okay, but anyway, thanks
for the call. I got to move through them. Let me go to John in New Jersey.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, John.
How are you? I'm a big fan. I have a couple questions. With these foreign stocks down, I'm getting very high dividend yields on my stocks now.
Well, no, you're not getting high. Like, let's assume you bought a stock and the yield was 10%, and it got cut in half, and now the yield for new buyers is 20%. You're not getting 20% on what you paid. You're still only getting 10% because of what you paid.
No, I understand that. I bought them after they already came down.
Right. So
I'm getting high dividend yields. But my question is, I hear, you know, I listen to a lot of the guys. Mark Saber is saying how I would assume with these stocks down, it's going to affect the earnings of these companies, and they are going to have to cut their dividends eventually.
No, I mean, and most of the companies that we own, their earnings are not affected. Their dividends are not being cut. The only companies that are having problems with their earnings are the commodity companies, because they're earning less because they're getting less for their commodities, right? So those companies might have to reduce their dividends. Or some companies that had a lot of debt on their balance sheet that is now more costly to refinance because of the credit crunch. So higher interest payments would be hurting their earnings. But the majority of the companies that we own, the earnings are fine. Now, if it's a foreign stock and the currency has gone down, so for example, let's say you had $10,000 in an Australian stock and it was paying you an 8% yield. Even if they haven't reduced their earnings, but the Australian dollar is down, it's not going to feel like 8% based on what you originally paid, because when you take the Australian dollars and convert them into U.S. dollars, you're not going to get as many of them. So from that respect, the dividends are coming down, but they're not coming down in Australian dollars. They're the same. They're only coming down in U.S. dollars because the Australian dollar has dropped.
Okay, but you know, ultimately, when the Australian dollar... some of the commodity companies do have lower earnings.
Yes, of course. All the commodity companies.
How often do companies like that reevaluate their yields, and will my broker proactively inform me that this is happening? Or?
No, not really. I mean, look, the dividends are going to change based on the earnings of the companies, and if the dividends get cut one year, they might be raised the other year. I mean, you don't know. We just hold the stocks and collect the dividends, whatever they are. Over time, the dividends should rise. But on any given year, if you're in a volatile industry where your earnings could swing based on what you can get for your commodities, the dividends are going to change.
Okay.
But you never know exactly what the dividend is going to be until they declare them, because they're in the U.S. I mean, the dividends are pretty much always the same because the dividends are so low. Compared to what the company earns if they pay a dividend, that, you know, they could say, all right, the dividend is 10 cents a share, 25 cents a share. But in companies that pay out much higher dividends, they generally pay out the majority of their earnings. And so they don't know what their dividends are going to be until they know what their earnings are.
How often do they declare them?
Depends on the dividend. Most stocks pay twice a year. Some stocks pay once a year. Some stocks pay four times a year. But the majority of stocks that I know of around the world, they pay twice a year.
Right. Okay. How seriously are you taking this Peter Schiff for Senate?
I'm not taking it seriously at all. I mean, I'm not running for anything. I mean, it's an interesting website. I visited. I think they do a very good job with it. But if they raise $7 million
just to lure you in, would you be tempted, or?
It's a long shot. I mean, it might be something that I want to do in the future. I just don't know if it's something I want to do, in the immediate future.
Right, right. Okay, well, I appreciate your time, Pete.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Lynn in New York.
Hi, Peter. I have a couple questions. Number one, the easy one, perhaps, is, assuming that you were advising the president and you wanted to prevent people from starving, but, spend as little as necessary out of the government treasury to do that, what basically would you be recommending to him?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, people aren't starving, and I think the best thing that we could do for hunger and for food is to end all farm subsidies, which is something that we could do immediately. The government should not be subsidizing farmers or discouraging farmers from farming. In fact, we need more of that. I mean, a lot of our food, I think we import more food now than we export. I know we import 90% of our seafood. I don't know what the reason is that, what kind of regulations we have that make fishing unproductive off American waters, but that should change. But, I mean, if I was advising the president, I would just tell him that we need to cut government everywhere and everywhere we can, and we need to make government as small as possible, because this country is in a lot of trouble, and we need to
but there are families who have to have where the breadwinner lost his job.
The breadwinner is going to have a better chance of getting his job back if the government gets out of the economy. Meanwhile,
yes,
the government
but
isn't
until
feed
he
people.
Does. And, but there is still a question of him starving before
he's not going to starve. There's plenty of food, and if the government stops subsidizing farmers, food prices would be more affordable. Meanwhile, if somebody really is starving, there are plenty of charitable organizations, there are plenty of soup kitchens and people places where people will give away food to people who really need it. We don't need the government to do these things. The private economy is more than capable of handling situations of need. I think much better than the government.
Now, the other question I have is, I speak to different people. My question really is, to what duration do you think the economic downturn in the world is going to...
Well, it's going to last for a long time in America. It's going to last for 5 or 10 years, maybe more, mainly because of what the government is doing. I mean, it wouldn't have to last this long if the government weren't, making one mistake after another. But the rest of the world will probably be a lot shorter, especially if the world can come to its senses and stop subsidizing our economy. If they stop suppressing their currencies, if they stop buying our debt, then the world, I think, is going to go through the biggest economic boom that we've ever seen.
I mean, do you think that, Europe has similar problems to ours.
No, they don't. They have problems, but they're not similar. There are some countries that have problems similar to ours, but on a smaller scale. But on a whole, I think that Europe is positioned quite well for the near term. I think there's a lot of negativity and pessimism on the euro that I think is misplaced. I think there should be a lot more concern about the dollar at this point than the euro. And I think that there are a lot of problems in the UK, but I do believe that the British pound will ultimately move and join the euro, and I think that will be a positive for the euro. That will be a vote of confidence in the euro. And I think it will be a very significant event to the potential evolution of the euro into a reserve currency where it might be able to replace the dollar in that role for some time. Ultimately, I think there will be no reserve currencies. Central banks should simply use gold as their reserves. But if in the interim, if there's going to be some type of currency that's to replace the dollar, there's a good chance it will be the euro.
All right, thanks very much.
Sure thing. All right, next caller is Justin in Texas.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Justin.
It's great to talk. I'm just really thankful you're doing everything that you're doing, firing. But my question is, I'll try to make it quick. I'm a college student, and I'm going to be applying to medical school within the next year. But to do that, I'm going to have to get a $100,000 loan from the government, most likely. Do you think this money is going to be available?
Yeah, I think the money is available, unfortunately. I think the reason that colleges cost so much is because that money is available. And so now you get to borrow the money and go to a school that you probably could have afforded anyway if the money wasn't available, because the tuition would have been a lot less expensive. But I guess, you know, like everybody else, you take the government loan because that's the only way you can go to school right now. I think the one consolation might be that you don't actually have to pay it back, because I think a lot of students are going to be defaulting on their loans, and of course there's going to be some kind of bailout for students. You know, just like there's a bailout for homeowners and there's going to be a bailout for credit card debts, I think people are going to be bailed out of their student loans. They're not going to have to pay them back, or they're going to pay them back with worthless money because we're going to have hyperinflation. So, probably from a personal point of view, you're probably fine to take the loan because you're not going to have to pay it back. One way or another, that debt's going to be removed from your shoulders. Either the government is going to say you don't have to pay it, or it's going to be massive inflation, and, you know, it won't feel like you're paying it.
Well, I guess it is it's a situation that's good for the debtor. My other question is, I guess, what do you see for the biotechnology field and the healthcare industry overall in the next 5-10 years?
Well, I mean, biotech is a very dangerous place to invest, and I look at it more as gambling, and, you know, unless you have inside information, which you're not technically supposed to trade on, so I stay away from it. As far as healthcare in general, I think it's going to be a weaker sector than people think, because people just assume that, well, we're always going to have healthcare. But you know what? We're too broke to afford all this expensive healthcare. So I think we're going to see a downturn in that sector, because I really don't think we can afford all the healthcare that we currently provide, at least with the government's involvement, which makes it so expensive. Anyway, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right, let me go to Jerry in Florida. And then I'm going to take one more call after Jerry, and then that's it. So no one else call. I think I have just these last two calls on hold. So, Jerry, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Pete.
Go ahead.
Do you mind discussing the difference between the Perth Mint and the company goldmoney.com that you mentioned in your book?
Yeah, well, the Gold Money is Jim Turk's site. And what that is, it's kind of like an online barter community where you can have gold. But you can all, and it's stored. I think they have a bank in Europe that holds gold, and you just buy and sell these gold grams on the internet, and you have an account. But you can also use the gold grams in your account to trade with other members of this network, where you can, you know, buy things and pay for it, as opposed to using your PayPal account on the internet. You can just use your gold grams, and you can, if something is for sale for 10 grams of gold and you have 10 grams of gold, you can move it from your account to their account. So it's kind of a way to barter using money. I mean, it shouldn't be barter. It should be just a regular transaction if gold were money. And the Perth Mint is just a depository in Australia, which will hold your gold, silver, or platinum for you. I think it's a great way to own the metal, because I think it's very easy to do. You don't have to. Right now, a lot of people are telling me they're having a hard time buying physical precious metals because the dealers are out of the coins. But here, you can buy the metal and have it stored in a government-owned mint in Australia, in a way that's safe and convenient, and you don't have to worry about, you know, your gold you're being stolen.
Pete, what would be the minimum on that?
The minimum on the Perth Mint is $10,000. I'm not sure what the minimum on gold money is. It's, I think it's lower than that.
Okay. Peter, I appreciate it. I think you're doing a great job.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Okay, the last caller is going to be Aaron from our neighbors to the north up in B.C., Canada.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Good. How are you?
Good. I heard you on Alex Jones' show today talking about Canada. And I was just wondering, I was thinking that, you know, the U.S., if things get bad enough, might try and strangle us through trade and, you know, get some of our resources that way. Do you think there's a possibility of kind of trade wars starting with the U.S.?
I don't think America can fight a trade war, because we're basically unarmed. I mean, all we can do is, you know, impose tariffs, which means we hurt ourselves. Because we keep foreign goods out or make foreign goods even more expensive than they're already going to be. So I really don't see anything happening in that respect. And I think that potentially, you know, Canada could suffer because they're very, you know, closely intertwined with the U.S. economy. But they're also got great potential to divert some of their exports to Asia and China as opposed to America. And they have a lot of resources, which I think are going to be in demand, and that's going to benefit the Canadians. And, you know, I think gold is going to take off. We're going to have a new gold rush, I think, in the world. And, you know, there's plenty of gold in Canada, and there's a whole industry that can not mine, and with not only mining in Canada, but, you know, other parts of the world. I mean, Canadian miners are involved in projects all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's about 9% of our trades with you. So, you know, they did it with softwood. And I was also wondering how familiar you are with GATA and if you kind of believe in some of their thoughts about gold price suppression.
Well, I don't know that there's a real concerted conspiracy among all the bankers to artificially suppress the price of gold. I know that the government certainly is happy when the price of gold is falling and doesn't like when it's rising. I don't know how aggressive they are trying to keep a lid on this price, but I don't think that it's hurting gold buyers. I think, if anything, it's helping us, because by keeping the price down, that means we get to buy more gold cheaper. Eventually, the price is going to go where it's going to go, regardless of any government attempts to manipulate it. And I think the price of gold is going dramatically higher.
Okay. Thanks for your time, Peter.
All right. Thank you. All right. About 4 minutes left. Anyway, so just getting back to what's been going on in the markets, I think that, you know, what we're seeing potentially with the bond market, you know, rolling over the way it has and the sharp decline, the stock market going down and retesting new lows. You know, this January for 2009, is the worst January in the history of the U.S. stock market. But the fact that the foreign markets are doing so much better now. I mean, most of the stocks that we're buying are considerably off their lows. I mean, there are a few stocks that are still close to the lows, but most of the stocks are anywhere from 20 to 50% above their October lows. And if you look at the gold stocks, most gold stocks are at least double their October lows. Many of the stocks that I own personally have gone up 3 to 4 times. In the last several months off their lows. So we've seen big moves up in gold and mining companies and silver mining companies. We've seen rather, you know, big gains, you know, 20 to 50% gains in most of the foreign names that we're involved in, many of them that are not even in the resource space. Yet the U.S. market has barely moved up. And so maybe we've finally diverged once again, or decoupled to an extent, and we're going to go back to the U.S. markets just dramatically underperforming the foreign markets. And even if the U.S. market doesn't, you know, completely collapse, the foreign markets, I think, could do very well. But, you know, technically speaking, if we break down a little bit more in the U.S. market, maybe we've got, you know, quite a bit more downside left. I don't know if we're going to get, you know, down into, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 range in the Dow. I just think the government is creating so much inflation that those type of nominal declines might not be likely, given all that inflation. But you never know. But I think the real decline in the value of U.S. assets is going to be very substantial. I still think that, you know, my 1-to-1 target for the Dow with gold seems likely. And I said, right, you know, we hit 8.7 ounces yesterday. and we're right around 9 today. But remember, this bear market started when the Dow was worth 43 ounces of gold 8 years ago. So it's gone from 43 down to 8.7. You know, I mean, is it such a stretch to think you can go from 8.7 to 1? I don't think so. And maybe if it doesn't go exactly to 1 to 1, but somewhere between 1 to 1 and 2 to 1 would be a meaningful decline. And somebody asked about the Perth Mint and gold money. Gold money you just get on the Internet. If you want to buy the Perth Mint, you got to call us up and speak to a Euro Pacific Capital broker, can walk you through what needs to be done on the Perth Mint. It's a very simple procedure to go through. And, get your gold. I mean, we're at about $900 an ounce right now. I think once it, really takes through, it closes above 1,000, which was that high that it hit last year, I think it's off the ratios. And at one point last year, I was predicting $2,000 gold in 2009, and I still think there's a good chance that prediction is going to pan out. Anyway, thanks everybody again for listening. I will be back again myself next week for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. In the meantime, call 800-727-7922 to either open an account or add to your account. Either way, you want to take advantage of the recent weakness in stocks around the world and strengthen the dollar, because I don't think it's going to last. And make sure to read my book if you haven't read Crash Proof, or the little book of Bull Moves in Bear Market. Thanks again, everybody. I'll be back next week.